Hello and welcome to another edition of Critical Q&A, the show where I answer your questions based on what you've left for me in the comments section of my Q&A videos or have sent to me by email at askchrisshelton@gmail.com. A couple of just announcement type things here is I will be starting a new channel soon, very, very shortly. I'm setting it up right now, The Critical Picture, and that will be dedicated to my movie interests and movie reviews and things like that. Because I figured that content is so different from the critical thinking, Scientology, more cerebral content that I post here on my Chris Shelton channel, and also, of course, my Sensibly Speaking podcast, that I thought I should make a whole separate channel for it. Now, if this is a really horrifically bad idea, let me know. But that's my thoughts on it. I started setting it up, and probably in the next day or two, that will be up and running, and I'll be posting my movie reviews there. And I would love it when I do that. I'll make a little video announcing that, and I'd love it if you guys would go over there and subscribe to that if you're interested in that kind of content. I've been doing the best that I know how to do to throw out some movie reviews. I'm a total cinephile. I love movies, always have, and I love talking about them. And so I thought that might be a whole nother interest. But it's, like I said, it's so different from the Scientology stuff that if people start wanting to get into, you know, following me for that, I think they might be thrown off by some of the other stuff I talk about. So anyway, that is happening. And for those Scientology watchers out there, if you haven't seen this week's Sensibly Speaking podcast, you really need to. I did an interview with John Atack, the author of A Piece of Blue Sky. And he and I talk about his new Open Minds Foundation organization and what he's doing with that. And also then get into talking about some Scientology stuff and Scientology's inevitable downfall as far as he and I are both concerned. And I thought that was some pretty interesting stuff. So take some time, check that podcast out. It's available here on my YouTube channel or at sensiblyspeaking.com. And now let's get on with your questions. Ross Geringer, are body thetans, BTs, mentioned anywhere outside the upper OT levels in Scientology? In other words, would a non-OT Scientologist, including Sea Org, since they don't seem to be privy to any secret upper-level doctrine unless they have worked their way up the bridge the same as public, be aware of BTs? I assume the answer to both questions is no, and thus you yourself were not aware of the concept of BTs until after leaving the church and reading the OT materials online. What did you think when you read about BTs? To me, that's almost as big of a revelation as the Xenu story to learn that there are supposedly other thetans clustered on various areas of the body causing all sorts of impairment. I would liken it to the discovery of bacteria and viruses and how revolutionary it was to see these previously unseen entities which have the ability to profoundly affect our health. Yeah, learning about BTs was not anything I knew about when I was in Scientology. I learned about it when I read the OT3 Xemu story online. And I'm just going to start calling him Xemu. I know everybody calls him Xenu, but the name is Xemu, and I clarify in my book why that's the case. Anyway, so no, I didn't know anything about BTs. Now, let me just comment on this because I think you'll find this kind of interesting. In Scientology's lower level materials, in the non-confidential materials, there are a couple of places where Hubbard alludes to other entities or other types of beings, and he refers to them as entities. There are one, there's in the 1952 book, The History of Man, which was also called How to Audit, he talks about entities. And you get this, the way he describes them and talks about them in lectures and later lectures and whatnot is that they were originally thought of as sort of compartmented sections of the individual, you know, if you have or his mind. You'd have a thetan, a spiritual being, and he's got this mind, and it contains not just pictures and experiences of his experiences, but it also has mental machinery. And Hubbard said that the machinery is literally machinery, like cogwheels and little turbines and little things that a thetan would create to do work for him. Like if you could imagine, building a mental calculator or something, and that calculator would actually do calculations for you. It's not just a mock-up or a picture of a calculator that, you know, you're going to invent. It's an actual machine that exists up here, and I keep going here, although it really could be anywhere. It's physical, it's made of energy, but it's non, you know, corporeal. You don't really see it or feel it or touch it. Anyway, this machinery exists, and the way Hubbard kind of explains it, if you read like all this stuff, you kind of get this idea that these entities are what he calls, he referred to them as circuits in Dianetics. They're walled off sections of the mind that act like other personalities, other beings. And so right from the Dianetics book, he's talking about circuits, mental circuits, like an electronic circuit. And maybe it's just a couple catchphrases, but then this evolved and developed into entities, whole personality packages that the Thetan creates, and they talk back to him and they act like a whole nother person. And sometimes the guy will take on those personalities, right? This isn't really clearly defined stuff. If I'm sounding a little bit vague or a little, you know, uncertain about this, it's only because Hubbard's materials are very vague and uncertain about this stuff. It's kind of like he's really making this stuff up as he goes. But this is lower level, non-confidential material that any Scientologist reads and knows about, is that there are these entities. And so the idea is it's part of you. Then there's another kind of entity, which is not you, which is a its own thing, which is called a genetic entity. And this is the closest Hubbard ever came to the concept of what he later in 1967 said were body thetans and, you know, whole spiritual beings that are just like you as a spiritual being, except they're dead or nearly dead and just glommed onto you, right? The genetic entity Hubbard described early on, again, this is 1952, 1953 material. This was the sort of vague, it was very hard. A lot of Scientologists really have a hard time getting their head around what the genetic entity is. And it was only really talked about in the 1950s. By the 60s, there wasn't any discussion about the genetic entity, and there wasn't any address to it or worry or concern about it. So it's kind of early stuff. But Hubbard posited this idea that bodies were sort of sustained and created by this genetic entity, which sort of went along from body to body along a genetic line and sort of developed bodies. And maybe the idea was that evolution, you know, evolving bodies and things like that were brought about by these genetic entities. And the genetic entity, Hubbard said, there's a whole lecture on this thing. I think it was 1956. It's called Genetic Scientology or something like that. Or Scientology in the GE or some GE Scientology. That's what it is. GE Scientology is the name of the lecture. And Hubbard talks in this lecture a lot about this genetic entity. It says it lives in the stomach, that it is a very kind of a craven, sort of a very primitive creature, that it wants to just eat and have sex and live and very primitive level of survival, and that he compared it to... he talked about Genghis Khan. He said Genghis Khan was a very GE-oriented individual, you know, killing lots and lots and lots of people, building his tower of skulls and this sort of, his mountain of skulls, that it was like that kind of primitive, raw, sort of, that's the GE, and it's going to survive no matter what sort of thing, and it's very much all about its own survival. And so when people, you know, when people get... hungry, really tired, things like that, the GE is kind of taking over. So that was what I remember about that. But I thought you might find that interesting as far as pre-OT level material about entities. Now, of course, when he developed OT3 in 1967, I think all this early material to the OTs is sort of considered, oh, well, Hubbard was really talking about BTs. But of course, because it was confidential and Hubbard said it would kill you if you knew about it before you could, you know, before you were aware of it, before you could be, you know, be safe to be told about it. He didn't go back and clarify all this early material, but I think OTs pretty much imagine that the GE and these earlier entities and stuff that Hubbard was talking about are actually BTs, you know, body thetans. So that is that's how that works in Scientology. And there's one final place in 1980. There's a bulletin called The Nature of a Being, and Hubbard there, well after the OT levels were all worked out, talks about entities and refers back to the earlier books. But I think he was just kind of covertly referring to body thetans, sort of, you know, surreptitiously referring to his earlier 1950s material, but really talking about body thetans without saying it out loud, where in The Nature of a Being, he describes the fact that we are not simple creatures, that if all it was a body and a thetan, a spiritual being, it would be easy to get people all the way up to clear and OT, and it wouldn't be a big deal. But that man is what he called a composite being, because you have all these other factors involved, the mind and the entities and whatnot. So he sort of alluded to it there, but there was no hint of clusters and body thetans and Xenu and all that stuff. That's all confidential material. So there's my tirade on entities in Scientology. Binkstram. Are you or were you ever a smoker? If you were, how did you quit? In their podcast on Scientology, Ross and Carrie mentioned the large number of Scientologists that were smoking outside the building, and I've seen videos of Sea Org members and or staff taking a smoke break. I know Hubbard smoked like a fiend, well, he was one, and dismissed it with the comment, nobody's perfect. Doesn't it seem a little disconnected that Scientology is so anti-drug but permits its members to smoke, unlike, say, the Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses, which don't allow smoking? I welcome your comments on this. For a while, I did smoke. I started smoking when I was in my early 20s, and I told myself when I started, because I was doing it really just to kind of be cool, that I wasn't going to let myself get addicted. So I never smoked a lot. I would buy a pack and it would take me 2 weeks to get through one pack. So I never really got used to it, let my body get so into it that I couldn't stop at any time, that sort of thing. I just did it because I thought it was kind of cool. And after I did it for a number of years, because I did it, you know, into being in the Sea Org, I would use it to kind of chill, you know, kind of calm down. And I have had a cigarette a couple times since I quit, but it's never really been a thing for me. I'm not really into cigarettes that much. They're way too expensive. I actually quit, like I quit when I landed on the RPF in 2005, because they were just too damn expensive. On the RPF, I was making like $11 or $12 a week. Like that was it. Here's your 11 bucks, you know, and that's all you got. And so you could buy cigarettes or you could save your money and maybe buy some snacks and stuff to sort of sustain you, because there was no chance of ever going out or anything like that. You had to buy everything in the canteen on the Sea Org base. So whatever was there was what you had available to you. And I knew people who, you know, just spent all that money on cigarettes and they smoked like chimneys. You know, they would on the RPF, they would eat for 5 minutes and then go smoke for 10, you know, when we had our 15, 20 minute meal breaks, you know? But I didn't. I just was like, wow, this is too expensive. I can't afford this. And cigarette prices were really going up at that point. I think while I was on the RPF back then in LA and California, they went up to, you know, $5 or $6 a pack or something, which was insane. So that's my own smoking experience. Hubbard talks in a lecture, in a St. Hill Special Briefing Course lecture in the 60s about nicotine and how it's actually good for you. and how, you know, there's the AMA and these guys are kind of lying about nicotine, and how actually your body, you know, really could use the nicotinic acid. So that was Hubbard's view on it. So he had it very, very well justified. And I heard within the Scientology world, Hubbard quit smoking in the 1970s. And I really don't know if that's true or not. I mean, you don't see any pictures of him in the 1970s or later with a cigarette in his mouth. Through the 60s and in the early years of the Sea Org, you hear him smoking in lectures. You know, you hear him opening up the cellophane, opening up packs of cigarettes, you know, taking a draw. He talks about cigarettes, talks about his cool cigarettes. That's what I smoked, by the way. I smoked Cools because I thought, hey, if it was good enough for Ron, it was good enough for me. But I didn't. I had filtered cigarettes. Ron smoked unfiltered. Anyway, so he had it pretty well justified. But I heard that he had quit, right? Because he, you know, the rumor line was that he quit because he knew it wasn't good for your body, right? And then, of course, you know, purification rundown and all that. Maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true. I honestly don't know. But I do know that in the 70s, Hubbard ran into major medical complications with his body. So it would make a lot of sense to me if he did quit smoking. As far as Scientologists go, especially Sea Org members, they smoke. Oh yeah, absolutely. Now they smoke a lot less than they used to because the laws changed and you couldn't smoke inside. Even on a Sea Org base, you can't smoke inside. Used to be, you know, when it wasn't California law, you could smoke wherever you wanted to, Sea Org members would be smoking indoors, outdoors, wherever. You know, now you have to take a break to go smoke, or you have to take a break during your meal time to go smoke, and that's the only time you get to smoke. And that really cut down a lot on Sea Org members smoking, because they don't get breaks. You know, if a Sea Org member is caught taking a break and smoking a cigarette outside of meal times, they're going to get in trouble for the most part, unless they're doing something productive in the meantime, right? They can go out and have a smoke while they're, you know, on the phone trying to sell somebody something, or, you know, something like that. So, or walking from one place to another on the base, you know. You'd see guys go up who are smokers, get up in the middle of the day and have to go run, you know, handle this errand on the other side of the base, right? And they're smoking the whole time, all the way there, walking the long way around, you know, just because they want to have a cigarette. So anyway, this kind of thing goes on in the Sea Org and whatnot. But as far as rules against it, there are no rules against smoking in the Sea Org. And I think it's such an accepted practice within the culture of Scientology. Some people, non-smokers, especially over time, especially since the 90s, I guess, you know, knowing that smoking is actually bad for your body, question why other Scientologists smoke. But they also, you know, give them room to have, you know, freedom of choice. I mean, nobody wants to, in Scientology, it's funny culturally, if I think about it, because I was going to say, it's not like anybody wants to dictate to other people what to do, which is kind of like, what? You know, in Scientology, huh? But it's just about certain things. You know, there's some things that are morally okay, and there's some things that aren't. And I think because Hubbard smoked for so long, and there isn't really evidence that he ever quit, I mean, one way or the other, you know, maybe the rumors are true, maybe they're not. You know, you can't really come down on somebody for doing something that Hubbard did, you know. So I think that might be why there's not such a, smoking isn't quite anathema to as many people in Scientology as it is to the rest of the world. Donald Drumpf. I know some people have said working for a Scientology-run company is like being in Scientology / the Sea Org. Do you agree? Well, yes and no. There isn't anything like being in the Sea Org, so no, not totally. There isn't any Scientology company that duplicates the environment and culture of the Sea Org. That is, it's just, the Sea Org is just a whole, its own thing. But there are definitely companies that act just like Scientology orgs. I actually talk about this with Larissa in my recent video series with her, with Larissa Smith, on the terrible culture of Scientology. So if you haven't seen that, then please do check it out. She worked for a company in Clearwater called MGE, which was a management consulting company that uses Scientology administrative technology use that term so loosely. And they run their staff just like staff members in a Scientology church are run. They use the Hubbard ethics system, the Hubbard management system, they use the Hubbard policies, right? The staff members have three basket communication system, an in, a pending, and an out basket. There's a communication center where all the communications, the dispatches and whatnot fly around. They use condition formulas, which is part of the ethics. And in Larissa's case, they were even using the e-meter at the place of business. This was not a Scientology organization. This was MGE, a supposed, you know, secular activity using the e-meter on its employees. So, you know, yeah, that's kind of like, talk about no separation of church and state. And these companies are mostly staffed by Scientologists. And so very rarely you hear about these cases where non-Scientologists are hired and they're forced to learn Scientology procedures and methods. And they don't like it. They don't want to do Scientology classes. They didn't sign on for that. And so they end up, you know, going to the Better Business Bureau and the Fair Trade, you know, groups and saying, hey, this company is forcing Scientology down my throat and I'm not interested. And so there's been lawsuits about this sort of thing. These companies, these are mainly run, they're started by a Scientologist or a family of Scientologists. They hire other Scientologists. These companies classically hire ex-Sea Org members. But get this, some of them are so in tune with Scientology and the culture of Scientology that they won't hire ex-Sea Org members because ex-Sea Org members, as I've gone over, are degraded beings, right? And they're too good. These Scientology companies are too good for ex-Sea Org members. I mean, in the Terrible Culture of Scientology videos, I really tried to get across the terrible culture of Scientology, and it is a culture. It's a very small culture, it's a very small number of people, but man, it's got so many rules and different things to it. It's crazy. And so yes, these companies do exist, and they are run like orgs. Dolly Jean. I have heard you and others explain the role of case supervisors and how they oversee the auditor's sessions to make sure there are no errors made and everything is done on source, using standard tech, etc. I have also heard there are what are called field auditors who offer services on their own, separate from the church, though except for some special cases, are supposed to charge the same rates so as not to undercut them. If they audit parishioners, is there no case supervisor who checks in after each session, or is everything completely in the hands of the field auditor? Is this a common practice, and how does the church feel about it in general? I appreciate any thoughts you have on this. Oh yeah, field auditors are part of the whole system of Scientology. They've managed to do away with almost every field auditor, just like they've managed to do away with almost every Scientology mission. Since the 80s, these things have been on a steady decline. I talked in earlier videos about the fact that, you know, auditors are practically an extinct race or species in Scientology, because that's Miscavige, what Miscavige wants. He doesn't want auditors around. He doesn't want that kind of thing going on. And so they've made it very, very, very difficult to become an auditor in Scientology. But there are still some around, and within the rules and policies of Scientology, you can train as an auditor and you can go out on your own bat and you can audit people. And the policies are you either charge nothing or you charge as much as or more than your local organization, because you can't undercut, like you said in the question. And field auditors are often trained as case supervisors, and they do their own case supervising, which is, you know, risky. Hubbard says not to do it. You know, you're supposed to have two people, so you have an objective look at the case, not the auditors, right? Because the auditor's kind of too close to the case. But you can do it. And also, the other option that field auditors have, if they're close to an org, because some of these guys are out in, you know, Montana and stuff, right? But some of them will pay their local church for case supervising time, and they pay by the hour for that. And I think it's like $300 or $400 or something. That's what it was back in the day. I don't know. It's probably more now. But they'll take the folders of their pre-clears into the org, and they'll have the case supervisor at the org do the CSing for them. So that's how they get direction on what to do with the case and whatnot. And they also pay the local church for any correction that they need if they screw up, make mistakes. If the case supervisor looks over the case and says, oh yeah, no, you didn't run this process right, they'll write a correction, a cramming order on the person, and the field auditor will then get it and have to pay the org for the correction that he gets. And that's usually charged by the hour or by the day, depending on how much correction there is to do. And if the guy screws up really bad, he might end up having to redo what's called a retread of a course, where he's got to redo in the classroom. He's got to go back and redo sections of his training because he screwed up so bad. Or if he really screws up after that, he might end up on a retrain where he has to do the entire course again from beginning to end. So that's, you know, some of the risks a field auditor takes if he's using his local church for his case administration services. But that's basically how that works. And the church would encourage that kind of activity, at least they're supposed to. Sometimes field auditors, sometimes because the orgs are doing so badly, you know, that they don't even have anybody getting any auditing, or they only have one or two people, they would consider that the field auditors are competition, and so they don't like them, right? I've seen that kind of attitude towards them. But they're supposed to service those field auditors and help them out. Jennifer Brewer, what's your feeling on the phenomenon that is The Walking Dead? Okay, The Walking Dead. This is not a show that I watch anymore. I did watch it through the first season. I thought it was very high production value, very well-made show, and I was intrigued by the premise, and I was not, you know, I had never read any of the graphic novels or comics. But it was dark, and I didn't trust that it was going in a direction that I thought was going to be, for me, entertaining. I'm not into dark and everybody dies and it's all so horrible and awful. I'm an optimist and I like things to be kind of optimistic, which is not to say that I can't appreciate a good, well-made movie that has a point going to it, which is a point I can agree with, where the hero or heroes die or sacrifice themselves or something. I can deal with that. But when it's just dark for being dark's sake, I'm not so into that kind of thing. And I'll tell you, the other thing I'm not into is I'm not into torture porn at all. I hate Eli Roth's movies. I hate anything having to do with just, you know, watching grisly, horrible things happen to people just for the sake of watching grisly, horrible things happen to people. And I think Eli Roth specializes in that. And Frank Darabont, who was the showrunner for the first season of The Walking Dead and has made some amazing movies. I mean, he's done adaptions of Stephen King material that was just mind-blowingly good. Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption. But he did an adaptation of a Stephen King story called The Mist. And at the end of that movie is probably one of the most disgusting, and I don't mean disgusting like, ooh, like it's gory. I mean, it's just disgusting. I was disgusted at the end of what Frank Darabont chose to do with that movie. It was way darker than even Stephen King ended it. And anyway, I was very, very unimpressed by that. So that was the direction that I thought the show was going to be going. And so I was kind of turned off by that, and I stopped watching it through seasons. I think I watched a lot of season two, but three and four, eh. Season five came back. I came back to it and started watching it again, and I started seeing, oh, maybe these guys are going somewhere. Maybe something's developing in a direction that it's not just all hopeless and it's all awful, and, you know, every week it's going to be, you know, ooh, who's going to die this week, right? But halfway through the season, I was like, nope, that's exactly what's going on. And I realized that this show appeals to people who, for some reason, and I can't explain why, but for whatever reason, they like to be kept in suspense, in painful, tortured suspense over whether these characters on this show are going to live or die. And I'm not into that. I don't have anything against them doing it, but I'm not going to do it. I call it torture porn. It's just pure, take your heart, rip it up, throw it on the ground, stomp on it, and give you no hope over and over and over again. I think that's sick. I don't think that's entertainment. I'm not entertained by it. And if somebody else is, great. You know, I know Eli Roth has a lot of fans. I know The Walking Dead has tons of fans. But I just see it as pure, heart-wrenching, horrible, disgusting torture. And I don't have anything to do with that show anymore. So that's my take on that. And take it or leave it. You know, I'm not asking you to agree with me. It's just you asked. So that's my answer. It's time for Flash Answers. Jonathan Mark, at what point did Hubbard stop supervising David Miscavige? Did Hubbard know and approve of the IAS charging thousands and even millions for statuses? As far as Hubbard was concerned, he never stopped supervising Miscavige. And according to what I've heard from certain other exes who were there at the time, David Miscavige was on the verge of being busted by L. Ron Hubbard. He had David Miscavige sec-checked, and David Miscavige was giving up the goods because he didn't really have any choice, and he was about to get the axe, but that information somehow didn't make it to Hubbard between David Miscavige and Pat Broker's collusion to keep Hubbard in the dark. Hubbard never found out, and Miscavige never got busted. Hubbard died very shortly thereafter, and Pat Broker got ousted in the power play, and Miscavige took over and ran the show and still does. And that's the battle royale that occurred back then. And no, Hubbard never, ever knew anything about the International Association of Scientologists. That is just guaranteed. There's no way that he knew, because Hubbard had at least once, maybe even twice, shut down similar operations that had occurred earlier in Scientology. Say what you will about Hubbard, he was not into straight donations. He wanted an exchange to be occurring with the public who purchased Scientology materials and Scientology services. He did not want them just giving money over for nothing in return. That was Miscavige's baby, 1,000%. And he did it because the church was hemorrhaging cash like crazy with all the legal battles that were going on in the 80s. And they needed money, and the IAS, the International Association of Scientologists, was Miscavige's own moonchild, and turned out to be a cash cow, just millions and millions of dollars. But it didn't start that way. It started with just everybody getting a membership, and there were no status levels. That developed. It all evolved into the monstrosity that it is now. But it didn't start out that way. It started much more gradually. John A. Why couldn't Hubbard have been arrested on the high seas for tax evasion? Because when you're on the high seas, you're in international waters, and then somebody has to come get you. And that is a very expensive thing to do. And who's going to do that for somebody who evaded some taxes or committed some fraud? I mean, really? You know, if you're in port and they can come grab you and the port authority can come, you know, grab your boat or something, yeah, fine, great. But when you're out there, you know, there is no international police organization that's got boats that goes chasing people down, at least none that I know of. And that's the exact reason Hubbard was out on the high seas, is because it was international waters where he was free from territorial police who were going to come nab him. Mark P., what became of some of the major mission holders after the mission holder meeting, 1980s, I think, where many of them were declared? Well, they were declared, so they, you know, went off and did their own thing. Some of them went off and became independent Scientologists. Some of them were just like, oh, fuck this, I'm done. And they never turned around and never looked back. But quite a few of them, you know, have spoken out. They are on forums, or they were. Or they were involved in, you know, writing books or journal. You know, they got involved with journalists and media and things like that. That some of them protested Scientology. You know, tried to try to you know, make their way back into Scientology. I mean, the full array of reactions that you would expect that people would have to getting, you know, kicked out from the church. But I don't have enough details, and I wasn't going to go off and do all the research on it just to answer this question, because. Kind of, you can do that, but I can tell you that they scattered to the winds in various ways. Klaus Olson, great work you are doing. You are for sure saving many lives. Have you ever considered the fact of placebo playing a major part of the feeling that it works? My experience talking to a Scientologist is that it, in average, works in about 30% of the cases, very close to the placebo. Thanks a lot, Klaus. And yeah, I have very much considered that. And I think I've mentioned that before on this show. John Atack and I very much talk about that in my podcast that we did this week. So check that out and you'll see what John and I have to say about that. Okay, so we've reached the end of another episode. Thank you very much for coming around. Leave your comments, criticisms, feedback, ideas, anything you got for me in the comment section. And I'm very much interested in what you have to say. I'm also interested in getting this content shared far and wide across the interwebs. Please help me out with that because you guys are what helped me grow my channel. And also, of course, consider following or subscribing on Patreon or throwing me some love that way, because your support is what keeps me going. Thanks a lot.